29th Alaska State Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to order. Today is October 7th, 2015. We're meeting in the Anchorage LIO building at 9 a.m. in the morning. I'd like to do a radio check on folks that are online, make sure that we've got you here. Madam Secretary, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Is our secretary online?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. And I believe we also have Representative Olson online. Are you there, Representative Olson?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Great. Well, with that, Madam Secretary, could you call our roll, please?
Yes, sir. Senator Steadman? Senator Bishop? Senator Giesel?
Here.
Senator Hoffman?
Here.
Senator Kelly? Senator McKinnon?
Here.
Representative Kito?
Here.
Representative Olson?
Here.
Representative Thompson?
Here.
Representative Pruitt? Representative Newman? Representative Hawker?
Present. With seven members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. Today we've got a long agenda for the LBNA meeting. We'll do our best to move as expeditiously as possible, and although we've got the afternoon blocked out till 5, I'm really going to try to get our presenters to wrap this up by 4 p.m. if we possibly can. But as always, we will take the time necessary to do the work that's ahead of us here. We've got a couple of RPLs to address to begin with. Then we'll be having advisory votes on those. Then the second half of our meeting, probably the second three-quarters of our meeting, will be discussing in executive session preliminary performance reviews conducted through the state auditor's office of the Department of Health and Human Services, certain agencies and divisions over there. Just for the committee's reference, we will require a quorum when we come out of that executive session, whatever time it is at the end of the day here, in order to move those preliminary performance review reports to the agencies for their comment and response before they go final here. But other than that, that's pretty much the agenda for the day. As I look around the room, I'd particularly like to welcome Representative Seaton. Good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you.
And certainly invite you to participate fully in the committee as always. Before we start down our agenda, does anyone on the committee have anything to bring up for the good of the order? Hearing, see none. With that, we'll first go to the first RPL, which is Department of Natural Resources, Fire Suppression, Land and Water Resources. The presenter on this is going to be Chris Mache. He's the director of the Division of Forestry. Chris, I believe you're online. Can you do a radio check with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, you're very loud and clear, so you can soften your voice a bit. We're in good shape with you there.
Okay, great.
What we'll do as usual, we'll ask you to present your request to us. I will have David Teal provide any concerns or questions or endorsements that have been brought forward by Legislative Finance Division. We'll vote on that one, and then we'll go to the second RPL, which is Department of Health and Social Services for some Senior Disability Services funding. So with that, Chris, would you please give us a brief explanation of what you're after and why you think it's a good thing?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning to you and the committee. Thanks for this opportunity to address you this morning. This is a challenge cost share agreement between the Division of Forestry and the U.S. Forest Service. It's an ongoing program that we've had with the Forest Service to help them manage the Tongass National Forest in southeast Alaska. We've been a participant in the Tongass Advisory Council for the last several years. And this cost shares agreement is the culmination of that TAC recommendation to the Forest Service on how best to transition from old growth timber harvest to young growth timber harvest on the Tongass while maintaining a viable timber industry. And so that's probably one of the key things the state has a lot of interest in, is maintaining the industry we have in Southeast Alaska and then having opportunity to regrow that industry as more of this young growth volume on the Tongass becomes available. This agreement's broken apart into two major tasks. I believe you have a handout there that I'll be speaking from. And the first page I'll talk to is Attachment A. It's page one. That's where the first order of work is outlined under task one of the agreement. There's three separate parts of that, but essentially all those A, B, and C boil down to
technical assistance. And I'm going to ask you to slow down a second while I...
Sorry, while you find it. You bet. So it'll be page 1 of 11, and it's labeled Attachment A at the top. It's a little ways back in the packet.
Got it. It's actually the final, the way we've got our packets organized, it's the final document in the packet. Attachment A, it's, and we'd look for the, towards the end of the packet, we've got the page 1 through 11 of 11. And
right.
And hang on just a second, Chris, here. We'd also, I'd like to acknowledge that we have Representative Pruitt joining us. Welcome, sir. Good to have you.
Okay.
Yep. It's 1 through 11 is the page. Yep. 1 through 11. And thank you. So I think we're all ready to go here, Chris.
Okay. I'll continue then. As you can see on page 1 of 11, there's at the top of the page, task 1 is the task I'll speak to first. And it has three subsets, subset A, B, and C, which are just different parts of the project to take a close look and provide technical assistance to the Forest Service, which would include field crews working with their staff, agreement on a protocol to do this work, and testing some new procedures, particularly on the task B part, which is the timber that is between 40 and 55 years of age. And you can see there's acreage targets associated with each of these three separate tasks. This work would get underway. We've already been having discussions with the Forest Service about the protocols and methodologies. This is really a merger of the two organizations in a sense. It's two different corporate cultures, two different ways of doing some of this technical type of work. And so we've been working to come to agreement on how we'll proceed with this in the field next summer when field season hits. So that's really the technical assistance piece. The goal of this is to identify the amount of young growth volume that becomes available over the next next 15 years that will be available for timber sales to help support the industry in Southeast Alaska.
This is Rep. Hocker with just a quick high-level question.
Mm-hmm.
The work you're proposing to do here, the purpose of this RPL is to accept $4 million of federal U.S. Forest Service funding. And is it my understanding correct that basically it's a sort of a, well, I guess it's a grant or it's a contract with you to perform these services? And then the information you gain from these, is it strictly proprietary to the state, or what else do you do with the information in that it's federally funded?
Yeah, no, to answer that last part of your question first, this is public, will be available to the as public information. It's not proprietary because it's management of National Forest Service system lands. So there'll be actually open data source on all this. And then, yes, your description of the project is correct. It's a $4 million cost share agreement that we do have a match requirement with, which I can address a little later here as we go along. It's to do this work to help, meet the mutual goals of sustaining a timber industry in Southeast Alaska. among other goals, but that's our one of our primary interests.
Okay, and I'll let you get to your point about the funding specifics at that point in your presentation here, so please continue.
Okay, I'll call it good for task one without going into the details of how we'll do that for all those separate age classes and move on to the other major task of this agreement. There is basically $2.5 million in this of the $4 million agreement allocated to task one, and then for task two, which is on page 4 of 11 in your document, there's $1.5 million allocated for the different three different items that we'll discuss here in this piece. And I'll just wait a minute here for you to get to that page.
Yeah, I think we're good on that.
All right. And as you'll see, it's task two. This has also three specific items, A, B, and C. The first one is provide workforce development and employment opportunities for residents of rural communities. Item B is improve infrastructure across the various land ownerships in Southeast. This can include state, private, municipal, or other lands. And then item C is to complete a forest resources assessment and provide financial assistance for other landowners in Southeast Alaska. $1.5 million is not a lot of money to do all three of those things, but we have detailed tasks associated with each of those, A, B, and C. There's no allocation of money to A, B, and C of that $1.5 that's been left up to us and the Forest Service to determine how best to do that, and a lot of this work will be done with potentially third-party contractors that will be selected through an RFP process.
Okay, Chris, let's take a pause there. Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chris, on task number two, I see that there was supposed to be a meeting in July with a final work product in August, I believe August 15th. Was that meeting held, and is that complete? And then if that is correct, why don't we have the specifics?
Yes, to answer your question, Senator, this is an ongoing project. The meetings were held, but because of our fire season that we had this year, many of the same people that are involved with this were engaged in dealing with the fire situation, both in our state and in the lower 48. So we're not quite as far along as we had hoped to be. You may have heard me mention that this is the merging of two different corporate cultures on how to conduct business, and so we've had a number of follow-up meetings, and we're making good progress on this, but we do not have a final agreement yet on how this will actually be done.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions at this time? Hearing see none. Go ahead, Chris.
Okay, I think I won't go into the details on those three items since they're all still being worked out. I will talk about the match briefly. It's a required 20% match. If you want to flip to, I think it's called page one, and it's toward the back of your packet, I believe. I don't know if I have the same packet assembled in the same order, but it should be after attachment A. There's a series of worksheets.
There are.
The first one there just says U.S. Forest Service off on the left, and it has Forest Service contributions and cooperator contributions.
Let's take a break. Slow us down until we get what you want. Is this the one that looks like a, it's a page, it's center of a white, a lot of white at the top and bottom, upper left-hand corner says U.S. Forest Service, on the right, OMB 0596.
That's correct. That's the sheet.
Yeah, I see everyone here with that in front of them.
Okay, and this is where it's actually documented as to what the Forest Service fiscally is bringing to the table, both in hard dollars and in-kind contributions, as well as the cooperator. And, of course, the state is the cooperator in this instance. And you can see that our match is about $1.4 million, so the match ratio is 75% Fed to 25% state. The state matches are in-kind in some salary and some travel, but the majority of the match is in the other line item. It's $1.3 million, and that's being matched by infrastructure improvements that we're making in Southeast. In this particular case, it's a CIP project that is constructing the Valner Bay Road on Gravina Island to a section of the state forest and to Forest Service owned land that will both have timber sales associated with them at some point in the future. So that match is sufficient to meet the required match for this, and in fact it exceeded the match by a little bit. I don't have anything else to present at this time, but would be happy to answer questions on this project. It is definitely comes at a good time for the division with the severe reductions we took in our workforce, and we will use some long-term non-perms and short-term non-perms to help conduct field work and oversee this project. And more than likely, we will be able to hire back a few of the folks that were laid off with the FY15 budget reductions.
Yeah, specific question for you, Chris, just making it very clear. The approximately $1.4 million in state match for this project is a non-cash requirement other than that it is money that is already in our state budget. You're not going to be asking for any additional support at any time to support this project.
No, that's correct. It's already either in kind, which is the salary and labor, or it's actually a cash contribution, but it's a CIP appropriation that has previously been made. And the Downer project's actually, it's not under construction yet, but it's close to being let out for construction. So, yeah, to answer your question, no additional funding is required.
Well, Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Thank you. And just to follow up on that line of questioning, because that was mine also, then we're allocating then out of your current travel budget line $21,000 going towards this project that won't be used for other travel opportunities. Is that correct?
That's correct. That was our estimate.
And then will your division or department be coming back and asking for a supplemental request?
No, we will not, because a lot of this travel is to Southeast Alaska, where I can combine my duties on this project with other state duties. So we can count that as an in-kind contribution, because it will involve work that's directly involved with this project as well.
Okay, thank you. Further questions for the sponsor here? Hearing, seeing none, that would bring the RPL itself before the committee for I'm getting half a step ahead of myself. David, you want to come up and just answer a couple quick questions? I'd like to introduce yourself. We've got David Teal with our Division of Ledge Audit. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division.
Did I say audit?
Yeah.
Okay. I was wrong. I stand corrected. Apologies. But Dave, you want to give just a quick synopsis of Ledge Finance's perspective on this request?
Mr. Chairman, we had no technical issues with it. Should note that the department originally submitted it as a capital project. When we asked them why capital instead of operating, they just chose to resubmit it as an operating RPL. Could have gone either way, but I think it does lean towards operating, and that means the department will have to do some work in the 17 budget process, but it's nothing that the committee should be concerned about. It works either way.
And the point being that it was a multiple-year appropriation, we've historically made those through the operating budget rather than a capital budget.
Correct.
So, any questions or concerns for Mr. Teal? Hearing, see none. Madam Vice Chair, I'd be ready for a motion if you're comfortable.
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that the committee approve the following RPL, 10-6-5006, Department of Natural Resources, Fire Suppression, Land and Water Resources, $4 million of federal receipts as a multi-year operating budget item from FY16 to FY18.
So the question before the committee is the adoption of the RPL for $4 million in federal receipts for these forestry services. Is there objection? Hearing, see none. Congratulations, Chris. You've got yourself an RPL.
Thank you much. Appreciate that. Thanks to the committee and the chair.
And we sincerely appreciate you taking the time, and sincerely that was one of the more thoroughly that the documentation behind that RPL was one of the most thorough I've seen in a very long time, and I really congratulate your folks on putting that one together. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll pass that word down the ranks.
Very well. Which brings us to our second RPL today. I'm not sure who's going to be doing the presentations here, but if you all want to come forward and introduce yourselves to us, this is a Department of Health and Human Services Senior and Disability Service request related to the general relief and temporary assisted living activities. General relief, GRA.
GRA.
And if you would please introduce yourself to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dwayne Mays, and I'm the Director for Senior and Disability Services. I do have our budget manager for the division online from Juno, Jaqueline Ziglipus, and I also have Al Wall, who is the Director for Behavioral Health, online as well, as Lifelines. And then we have Jeff Jesse in the audience who may be able to assist, depending on the question. So, would you like me to kind of do a high-level summary? Or
very much so. I mean, just presume, well, remember, we're creating a record of the process here, public record. So what would you like to leave for all posterity in explaining to us why we would want to comply with your request?
Okay. So general relief, assisted living, is a program that's been in existence since 2004, 2005. Within the Division of Senior Disability Services, we have a component called Adult Protective Services. So it's protecting our vulnerable population, seniors, throughout the state. When we receive a report of harm, and then we have investigators in the Adult Protective Services, they will go out and investigate that. If they confirm that the individual is at risk, we will remove them, if they're in agreement, from that location, and we place them into assisted living homes under the general relief program. So it's an emergent need. It's a safety net for vulnerable populations. We then develop an exit strategy to either return them to where they came from or to other locations. Over time, we have also taken in referrals. When we talk about vulnerable populations, we take referrals from the Alaska Psychiatric Institute when they want to discharge and they're ready to discharge. Some of those individuals come to the general relief program. We also have the Department of Corrections, our vulnerable populations that are coming out of corrections, may be discharged to the general relief program. The Office of Public Advocacy, where individuals that are vulnerable and have legal guardians may be discharged or sent to us in terms of housing. So just to kind of give you a high-level profile where those referrals come from, it's a GF program. We had $8.1 million in funding last year. Through the last session in the new governor's budget, we took about an $800,000 reduction. It's about 9%. And so we're working with Behavioral Health and with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to develop this proposal that actually was approved through HUD, the 811 program, to increase exit strategies for individuals on general relief into permanent supportive housing. The program that we have is just, it's temporary in nature, so we have about 600 individuals that are currently on general relief. So with the 811 project, permanent supportive housing, looking at existing housing units throughout the state, we would remove for the first year about 60 individuals from general relief and place them into these permanent supportive housing entities throughout the state and use, and then the grant that we received through the 811 program would pay for the subsidies. So to do that, though, we have to get a handle on the 600 individuals that we have in our program. So to enter the program, we take an application, we look at medical documentation, and that's our process. But we really need to do a comprehensive assessment, a functional assessment, and a housing survey, if you will, so we can get a better grip on what their needs are, so that we have a more appropriate exit strategy for these individuals. I think I'll stop there and just pause for a moment to give you an opportunity.
Okay, so you know, that whole thing, you never said what you were asking for.
Oh, very good. So the amount that we're asking for is MTAR funding through the Last Mile Health Trust in the amount of $175,000. So we would want to hire a contractor to actually be trained to a tool that we identified. It's called a DLA, Daily Living Activities 20 is the term that we use. The state of Georgia actually uses it, so it's a tool that's been validated and verified and actualized, and we would want to use this tool to do this very comprehensive assessment of these individuals. It takes about 2 to 3 hours to do the assessment, and then the results of that will then give us the information that we need to make the appropriate referrals. So we're asking for $175,000 through the Last Mile Health Trust to do that. We believe that it's, you know, we are comfortable in saying that it's a one-time only request. We get through the 600 that we currently have on the program, have a good analysis of each individual, and then we have the capacity internally to do ongoing assessments using that tool. But the 600 right now is something that we just can't do with our existing staff. We have other components where we're doing assessments, and the growth of our population continues to go up, so we're challenged to be able to do these assessments in the amount of 600. So the contract would be for one year only to assess these individuals so we can do a better job of exiting them out of general relief.
Senator Hoffman, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you briefly describe, of the 600, where these individuals are throughout the state of Alaska?
I would say that through the chair, representative for Senator Hoffman, about 70 to 80% of these individuals are in urban areas, South Central, Fairbanks. We do have a smaller percent in rural Alaska. So this is the assessment contract. Would be to assess all of these individuals throughout the state.
And just a question from me here. You're asking for receipt authority for a new other fund source of $175,000 to complete this activity. The senior disability services allocation within the budget, where you have authority to administratively shuffle money as need be, is $17.9 million. You don't have $175 anywhere in that $17.9?
Mr. Chairman, we have other components. We have our home community-based services waiver component.
$4.6 million.
We also have our personal care attendant program, where we, every year, we assess the individual, determine what their needs are ongoing. So just putting this out there, we are challenged by the growth. And over the years, there was a time where we had a backlog on our ability to keep up with the assessments. We have 17 assessors in our division. And so we had to get lean and mean and revisit some of our structures, look at our existing tools, do what we can to try to streamline. So for lack of a better word, we're just kind of hanging on trying to deal with all of the volume and all these different components. So I guess my response would be that we have a challenge to be able to keep up with all of this work.
You have... That didn't answer my question. Respectfully, that didn't answer my question. You cannot find $175,000 in your almost $18 million budget to cover this additional cost of a new contractor.
So, Mr. Chairman, would it be right if I call upon our budget manager?
You're always welcome to call a lifeline here.
Thank you.
So who would you like to call to the table?
So what I would like, she's actually in Juneau. She's our... Administrative Operations Manager, our Budget Manager. Her name is Jaqueline Ziegenfuss.
Ms. Ziegenfuss, are you available?
She's on her way.
How long are we going to be waiting? Do I take an at ease?
My apologies. I'm here, and for the record, my name is Jaqueline Ziganfuss. I am the operations admin operations manager for the Division of Senior and Disability Services.
And so, the question posed that's been handed off to you was: this is a request for $175,000 of new receipt authority in order to hire a third-party contractor to conduct certain assessments. Your overall budget, as it exists and is approved by the legislature for the Senior and Disability Services allocation, is $17,926,800. Do you not have capacity somewhere in that nearly $18 million to come up with and find a way to shift $175,000 to this project if it's of sufficient priority?
For the record, I do not believe that we have sufficient authorization given the reductions that occurred for FY16, given that this is a GF program. The assessments that we do for several of our waiver components have a federal component, so we receive a 50% federal match for those assessments, which we would not receive for the contract. We would not be able to utilize federal dollars in initiating the contract for the general relief assessments.
So did I just hear you say that if we accept this money from an other receipt authority and it's not general funds, we lose 50% federal reimbursement that we would get if we found some way to reallocate some general funds to this?
I'm sorry, no. To clarify, the other assessments for our waiver programs that Duane had mentioned earlier in his testimony are for Medicaid services. Therefore, we receive a 50% federal FFP match for those. These assessments are different in that we would be requesting, we would be assessing clients of a pure GF program. Therefore, we would not receive a federal match for these assessments. So if we were to reshuffle, in essence, we would be losing the match.
Okay, so then the question, do you have within your $18 million appropriation, or even within Senior and Disability Services, that you have the administrative latitude to allocate as you choose? Do you have $175,000 that you can find to reprioritize to this activity?
That would require reprioritizing within the division.
That is correct.
We do not have funds available that have not already been allocated, so...
That is also correct. You have just made two statements of fact. I'm asking you to draw a conclusion from those statements.
No.
We'll pass. You'll waive that one. I think we've got our answer here.
Can I answer that?
Wayne, please continue.
We, as a result of kind of where we're at today compared to last year, we had to reduce our staff by 24 positions, and that actually happened. So now we take all of those functions of those 24 staff and have to absorb it within our division. It's a good question that you're asking. I live this every day. I talk with Jaqueline. We are extremely tight, and so we're doing business lean throughout the division to kind of reconfigure how we're going to be able to meet workload demand. We lost 24 positions this last year. Those are our challenges. So I'd like, I wish I could say to you, yeah, we could probably find that, but I know in talking with Tukeli, and I know in meeting with the leadership team for the division, we're looking at all of our components to see if we can come up with some additional funding to meet needs throughout the division. It's a challenge.
So, I guess, Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dwayne, when you tell the committee that you lost 24 positions, were those all filled positions then, or were they vacant positions? Can you give us some idea of actual workload transition? And I know that your team, we all know that your team works very diligently and very hard to accomplish things for the people of Alaska, services important to each Alaskan, but how many... We are trying to find out from the administration. Senate Finance met this past Monday asking the administration for some of those numbers, and it wasn't readily available. So that's why I'm asking the question. Was it 24 people that were able to serve the people of Alaska, or were there some vacancies in that number?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, the 24, I know this because I'll remember it for a long time. They were all filled positions, and they were non-perm positions, so I want to put that out there. Non-perm positions, some of them around for a couple of years, some 3, 4, 5 years. I went and met with each one of those individuals to give them their pink slip.
Mr. Chairman, if I might follow up.
Please, ma'am, continue.
So then, and I hate to bring this up, but we hired then over for applications for Medicaid expansion. You hired individuals to start processing applications to take on more responsibility?
The 24, through the chair, the 24 positions were throughout our division, so some were that, yes. Others within our quality assurance unit, we have a variety of components. We had two positions in our adult protective services unit. We had assistant type of positions, so it was scattered throughout our division.
I don't want to push back too hard because I understand we all make choices, but what I'm saying is you let 24 people go and you hired how many people on the other side to implement Medicaid expansion, because that was a choice. And I believe that some of us said that that is a choice that was going to impact seniors and people with disabilities.
Through the chair, you're speaking to the issue of Medicaid expansion, bringing on additional positions.
And this administration did that, is that correct?
That's correct.
Was it 24, less or more? You know?
I couldn't. I apologize, but I couldn't answer that.
Thank you.
Administrative question. The vote of this committee is advisory. You have the authority, after 45 days of submitting notice to us with this RPL, to go ahead and do with it as you will, regardless of what our opinion is of this committee. Will you respect the opinion of this committee, or will you commit to respect the opinion of this committee in not going forward with this if we do not approve it today?
Mr. Chairman, so I understand what you just said. I wasn't aware of that. You know, what you're saying is after so many days that we can go ahead and move forward with this regardless of the decision that's made here.
You're not aware of the process by which Medicaid expansion occurred, and you're in the Department of Health and Human Services?
I'm just telling you what I know.
Hey, I get it. Representative Pruitt, sir, then Representative Keto.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Is there someone that can actually speak to that? I know the I want to confirm, and I read where we have in the legal services memo on the third paragraph on the first page where it highlights that statute, increase of appropriation based on additional federal or other program receipts. And in this case, we're not talking about the federal, which was the Medicaid expansion grant. So I want to, is the other program receipts, is that where, because this is a mental health trust authority, it falls within that phrase right there?
Representative Pruitt, the answer to your question is yes, but I'm a legislator, therefore I obviously have a question judgment. That's why I've got a lawyer online
exactly
for you.
Yes.
So I've got online for questions Megan Wallace of Ledge Legal. Megan, are you available?
Hello, this is Megan Wallace with Legal Services.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair. That is correct, the statement by the chair. These funds, the MTAR funds, are considered program receipts and therefore are subject to the RPL process.
Representative Pruitt, please continue at your leisure.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it, Mr. Chair. So if it's okay, I have a dialogue, a couple questions here for you. So if this were general fund money, that wouldn't be the case. Is that correct?
That is correct.
But if this is, and follow up on that, but if this is, and I'm going to look at other departments, if this is statutorily designated receipts of programs such as, and earlier we were talking about, in DNR we were talking about forestry, and they have certain designated receipts. If it was an expansion of that program and utilizing those receipts, would we have the ability to say yes or no, and then could the governor, after 45 days, go ahead and approve the utilization of those monies?
If the additional program receipts that you're referring to had not already been appropriated, then it is my understanding that, yes, he would be able to utilize that program. But the legislature does already appropriate some program receipts in the budget, so it would have to be additional program receipts received that the legislature didn't anticipate or previously appropriate.
Okay, so I think, and I'm just going to sum it up, what I understand is the only thing that the governor can't override us after 45 days on is specifically general fund money. If he can find it in some other pocket somewhere, he can go ahead and use it.
As long as it is federal or other program receipts that have not previously been appropriated, then yes, he can make the request through the RPL process. Now, I would just give the caveat that you would have to take each RPL as they come and examine each one, but generally, yes, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Quito, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm thinking about just in terms of clarification, my understanding is...
We can't hear you. Can you...
Sorry. Okay. How's that?
There we go.
Okay. So from my understanding, I just think for clarification, what I would like to understand is this $175,000, if the department were to try and get that $175,000 from another portion of the division, then that would mean $175,000 of match funding for federal Medicaid receipts would not be available, so we would be turning back another $175,000 of Medicaid receipts. So that's the first question. I think seems like the discussion that was happening earlier. The second was in regard to additional program receipts, and I think we as a legislature don't always anticipate all of the available program receipts for various programs. So if we do receive more money than we anticipate, this process that we're going through now, that we look at that money and then allow for that money to be utilized to provide state services. I think that's what Megan Wallace had indicated too. But I think for clarification, I just want to make sure that $175,000, if you did try and take it out of your division in another place, would jeopardize our ability to bring in some federal Medicaid receipts. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, if I could I bring Jeff Jesse to the table?
I believe Senator McKinnon was about to ask for that. Jeff, would you like to come forward and join us? If you put yourself on the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And as to Representative Quito's most recent question, I think that's more of a question for the fiscal folks than for me.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jeff, thank you for the work in managing the funds for the people of Alaska who benefit from the Mental Health Trust Authority and the leadership that you've provided. This is going to go right back to the Medicaid expansion. How can the legislature in the next round have confidence in the numbers that you bring forward to us for your receipt authority? Can you tell us first how you funded Medicaid expansion and the administrative costs without coming to this committee to ask for that transfer, and then now that you've made another $175,000 available for something else, And then maybe we could ask what's remaining. Is there still more funds that are available to do other things that the legislature may have wanted to weigh in on as far as utilizing those for other benefits that your beneficiaries might need?
Yeah, Senator McKinnon, through the chair, let's talk about Medicaid expansion. The trustees recognize the challenges that the state would face in implementing Medicaid expansion. We did believe that on the whole, it was going to be a net financial benefit not only to the state but to our beneficiaries. Literally thousands of beneficiaries would become eligible under Medicaid expansion. So in an effort to assist, the trustees authorized the first year administrative expenses, the hiring of people to do the eligibility work and to process the claims, as a way of making essentially that first year a no-cost effort from an administrative standpoint to get things started, with the idea that then the savings that would come from expansion, which we believe are real, would then offset ongoing administrative expenses. For example, I worked personally on looking at the Department of Corrections numbers for the number of inmates that would be eligible under expansion. If they were to go into a hospital for 24 hours or more, would they be able to then be paid for by the Medicaid program as opposed to now where they're paid 100% by GF? I was very confident after looking at the data that there were hard savings of at least $5 million in that. So the trustees made those administrative expenses available, and that was discussed during the session as the various bills went through the process. When the session ended and we went into the special session, our view was that, look, the trustees were making that money available if the state chose to go ahead with expansion and pursue making these folks eligible and trying to improve services and save money over the long run. How the state made that decision was a political one, in our view. Obviously, it involved the legislature and the administration, and there were many, many discussions, disagreements, etc. It wasn't our view that it was our job to weigh in on one side or the other of that larger political debate. So we were simply waiting for a decision to be made as to whether expansion would be going forward or not. If the court had told the state that it couldn't go forward with expansion, then our money would not have been available. If the legislature had decided to approve expansion, then our money would have been available.
Jeffrey, if I could get to the question.
Yeah.
The question was, where did you find the new money to make it available after the legislature did not act on Medicaid, and now you've apparently found more receipts? So how much more, and the last question was, how many more receipts are still available to be distributed based on what you presented the legislature, which was a very different picture on your allocation of receipts?
I'd like to add just a bit of an additional request to Senator McKinnon's request there. Perhaps it would be appropriate to include sort of a brief summation of how the Mental Health Trust Authority operates and what the legislature's jurisdiction over your funds are.
Okay. Well, let me tell you briefly kind of how we operate. We have an asset management policy that works like this. We are a percentage of market value entity as to our cash assets that are primarily in the permanent fund, with a small portion of reserve income.
That is your permanent fund, or the ones managed by the permanent fund. When you said it is in the permanent fund, let's be real careful with that.
Our funds, our cash funds, the corpus, is managed by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. We're like a little bit of a mutual fund. We pay our share of expenses. We get our share of their profit or loss. We distribute money from that corpus on a percentage of market value basis, 4.25% a year. And so that goes into a pool that is available in the following year for the expenses, administrative expenses, and also the programmatic expenses of the trust, of the mental health program. In addition, the trust land office generates income from our natural resources and lands, and that is added to that payout from the permanent fund. There's also lapsed funds that come into there each year. There's some other smaller sources of funds. The trustees have the ability to spend that money without a legislative appropriation, directly making contracts or grants to entities in the state. However, if we want to work through a state agency, then just like federal funds, they have to have receipt authority in order to receive and expend those funds. That's why it's called MTAR, which is Mental Health Trust Authority Authorized Receipts. So the legislature isn't essentially, they're not appropriating trust funds, they're authorizing the receipt of those funds. Just as you do federal funds. You don't appropriate federal money. You authorize agencies to receive and expend those funds. So the trustees every year go through and they make budget recommendations based upon our focus areas, based upon our collaborations with other state agencies, often based on our collaboration with the legislature, with initiatives that you want to pursue that we can assist with. And any of those funds that are designated to come through a state agency is approved as MTAR, or those state agencies cannot receive those funds. The trustees generally have, I think this gets to your point of your question, Senator McKinnon, the trustees generally do not, at their September meeting where they set out our budget, allocate 100% of the projected available income. Usually they hold back anywhere from $600,000 to $1 million out of about $24 million for a variety of things. For example, it might be during our conversations with the Office of Management and Budget, which we are ongoing now, where the administration, this one or others, might say, hey, we want to pursue this initiative. We could really use some help from the trust. Well, because we have some unallocated funds, we're able on occasion to do that. Similarly, when we get into the legislative process, if the legislature has certain things that you want to see accomplished, that you think the trust could be helpful with, then we have those unallocated funds available to help with that as well. So, for example, this last session, when we were all talking about reducing recidivism, we had the Pew Foundation folks coming up. They were going to collect data to try to, you know, develop a really data-based approach to reducing the prison population. One of the things we realized is that, well, having Pew come up for 6 months and crunch data was good, but what's the ongoing data collection and analysis capacity that we needed? Well, that meant we had to create some capacity to do that. And working with Representative Newman, what we looked at is, well, we have the Justice Center at UAA that does a lot of that work, but really didn't have the capacity to track, collect, and track this criminal justice data over time. And so we worked with Representative Newman, and I believe it might have been one of the only new programs created in the last legislature, and funded the Alaska Criminal Justice Information Center at the Justice Center, and we split that cost, $125,000 of GF, and $125,000 of MTAR. Now, normally, as many of you are familiar, the trustees would normally say, well, okay, this is really a state function. You know, we can only fund this for a certain amount of time. And then at some point, the state's going to have to take over. And that's been an issue on occasion. But the trustees didn't make that condition for this Justice Center project because we realize that the state is in a fiscal crisis or dilemma, and that this function needed to keep going for some length of time. Now, they haven't made a specific timeline on that, but that's part of where that unallocated funding becomes available to you by working with the trustees to partner and collaborate. So on this particular project, the way we looked at this is, look, we've got two things that we know are going to happen no matter what. One is we are going to reduce the budget. And so we have to do better with the money that we have, and in fact, we're going to end up with less money in these programs. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we have to reform the systems that we have. General Relief is a good example of a well-intentioned program that's funded exclusively with general funds. It has become, in our view, somewhat of a default program to put people in order to get them housing. Well, that's a good thing, but when general funds are going to be reduced, how are those people going to be served? You know, they are a vulnerable population. That's why they're coming from Adult Protective Services. And so when the reduction was made in this program, what we did is talk to the department and say, all right, look, you've already got one reduction in this program, so that's going to reduce service. We've got to start looking even farther ahead because there may be additional cuts in the future or cuts in other places where it will put more pressure on the general relief program. So what can we do to look forward and look at how to reform general relief so that it has the minimal impact on the state general fund?
Mr. Jesse, I really, with all respect, I'm trying to get to where you came up with the money. So you just told this committee that you, the board, set aside between $600 and $1 million of unallocated money, and I have heard what you believe is appropriate for use of that funds later, and I appreciate the chairman actually putting that on the record. What is the specific amount that the board allocated for administrative costs? Because I believe it was over $1 million, $1.4 million, I believe. So that is in excess of what you just told this committee you had available. And now you're before us again offering other funds that are available. So one, where did they come from? If you, I would guess, gave the legislature during your discussions the 4.25% of market value payout to allocate, what's the difference? It's quite a bit of money, and how much more is sitting there that is unallocated to beneficiaries?
Yeah. Senator, then I'll have to go into a little more detail about how the trust works, and I will get exactly to the question that you want to know. Where did the $1.4 million come from?
As high level as you can get would be appreciated.
I'll
right now. The chairman's been giving us quite a bit of latitude to go down this path.
Yeah, I'll do my best. In addition to the payout that the trustees make every year, what we do, the way our system works, is the trustees also have an obligation to inflation proof. So in any given year, what we look at is what are the earnings from the permanent fund that come into the trust, and how do they then compare to this 4.25 payout? Now, one of the problems or challenges for us is that we're a perpetual trust, so we cannot go into the principal of the fund. As a result, the trustees have set up an income reserve of four times that payout, with the idea being that in years where the permanent fund returns less than the 4.25% that's the payout, then the payout can still come from that reserve. And it has been an incredibly resilient model. For example, in the 90s and again recently, when the permanent fund had negative returns, we were able to continue to make the payout out of that reserve. Now, in years where the permanent fund's return is greater than the 4.25%, the first call on that money is into the reserve. So if our reserve is short of 400%, and the permanent fund returns more than 4.25%, the first thing we do is fill up that reserve. The next thing that that money is available for under our system is inflation proofing. And then we track inflation proofing over time, and when the reserve is fully funded and the principal is fully inflation proofed, then the trustees can review the payout for a potential increase. So, for example, when we started in 1995, the payout was only 3%. Well, we funded the reserve, we inflation-proofed the original $200 million, and then we increased the payout, because the permanent fund was doing very well, to 3.25%.
That's board managing your reserves.
Yes. And so over the years, as we've been able to fully fund the reserve, and inflation-proof, and still had additional income, we've been able to increase the payout to 4.25%. What's happened at 4.25% is we've had these market ups and downs, and we found ourselves short in some years on being able to inflation-proof, and in a few years, although not recently, we've had additional funds that we were able to inflation-proof. This last year, and I'm going to approximate the numbers, the excess, if you will, above the payout and above the reserve was in the neighborhood of $30 million. We need about $38 million to catch up with inflation proofing. The trustees discussed this, and the discussion was, what is the purpose of inflation proofing? The purpose of inflation proofing is to protect future beneficiaries by ensuring that the principal continues to provide resources for the mental health program then and not overcommit to the current year's beneficiaries. And so when the discussion of Medicaid expansion came up, the trustees discussed, well, okay, as you pointed out, the $1.4 million is in excess of what we have left unallocated. Is there someplace else that the trustees could use trust income in order to protect future beneficiaries? Well, that could come out of the $30 million that's available for inflation proofing. And so that $1.4 million is coming out of that additional income above the payout and above filling the reserve that would be available for inflation proofing. And their argument is that getting literally thousands of beneficiaries covered by health insurance now is way more valuable to future beneficiaries than what $1.4 million put into the permanent fund for inflation proofing would generate over that future time frame. That is an unusual action on the part of the trustees based upon what they saw as a unique opportunity to protect thousands of beneficiaries for a long time to come. So that $1.4 million is coming out of that additional funds that are available for inflation proofing. And it leaves us, instead of $8 million or so short of fully inflation proofing the fund, about 9.4 short of fully inflation proofing the fund, which, if you look at the macro level, as the fund revenue and expenses change over time, is a very small percentage of the overall fund. I have to do the numbers, but $1.4 million of $550 million, somebody will have to help me do the math, but it's a small, small percentage. The other reason that they took that out of that fund was to preserve the unallocated funding so that we could do things like the Criminal Justice Information Center and this particular RPL.
And sincerely, I appreciate the background and history there. Again, it's one that even I'd forgotten a couple of those points along the way. I definitely appreciate that. I know Senator McKinnon, I think, has a final question here.
Mr. Chair. Chairman, it's not a question. Medicaid expansion was a policy choice. It wasn't a political choice. So I think this administration chose, from a policy perspective, to expand Medicaid, and it had nothing to do with politics. We have active bills in our committee. The session is not over, and some fairly newly elected people that are trying to understand a very complex issue. So I would just put on the record that it's a policy discussion, and it is not political.
Well, Senator McKinnon, I apologize if there was some implication of that. What I meant was political in the sense of a separation of powers decision, not that it was somehow partisan or something else, just that there are two branches of government that had to figure out whether the state was going to go forward with that or not, and we aren't part of that in the sense of trying to take sides or, I mean, we're just trying to protect the beneficiaries.
Thank you. I'd like to note for the record that Representative Sadler joined us about halfway through this last series of questions. Representative Sadler, welcome, and you're certainly more than welcome to participate in the dialogue. What I'd like at this time is I'd like to ask David Teal to come forward.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, pardon me. Senator Hoffman, please.
Jeff Jesse, so to get me clear on the issue, the 1.4 was taken out of inflation proofing and not out of a combination of the unallocated $601 million.
Yeah, Senator Hoffman, through the chair, yes, it was taken out of what was available for inflation.
And the question that I have is that, so you're asking this committee to spend $175,000 out of the unallocated portion of $601 million.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, yes, that's correct, in order to avoid a short-term reduction in service. I mean, that was what I think persuaded us, is if the division had to get this one-time funding out of the rest of the program, it would reduce direct services. And we felt that since it's an administrative function, we would rather supply those funds than to have the services to the beneficiaries reduced.
So I understand that now, and the decision to spend the 1.4 was the board's decision. And these dollars, because of the nature, have to be allocated by this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And thank you, Senator Hoffman. You're always welcome here. I also have a question from Representative Pruitt and Representative Sadler. I apologize to the committee. I didn't mean to try to cut off dialogue and discussion here. I thought we had all the questions, but we will, of course, stay here with questions for this panel as long as anybody has questions. So, Representative Pruitt, sir.
Yeah, thank you. Just a couple clarifications for myself on what you just talked about. The first, the inflation proofing that you were discussing, it sounded like that was over several years that $30 million has been built up. Did I understand that correct?
Representative Pruitt, to the chair, no, actually that's in the last year.
Okay. Does that become part of the principal?
Representative Pruitt, to the chair, it has in the past. The trustees have started to, I know this gets complicated, but they started to put that into what they call a nominal designation, so that for accounting purposes it is considered part of the principal, but it's not. It's in a category where the trustees could access it if they needed to. So it's kind of a hybrid between income and principal. Because once it's in the principal, we can't get at it.
Okay, so they've been given the leeway to manage that as they felt in terms of do they have the ability to touch it at a future time frame, or like the permanent fund where we place the inflation proofing, it goes into the principal and is not available for appropriation to the legislature. So they've been given that leeway to make that decision, if I understood that correct. So then, to add up, for money to be expended by the Mental Health Trust Authority, does it have to have the approval of the board, or can the administration determine, because we've just talked about how they don't necessarily need us to say, yes, you can use some of that money. Can the administration utilize that money without going through the board for services or whatever they may feel that they need to expend it?
Representative Pruitt, to the chair, absolutely not. Neither the governor, the administration, or the legislature can expend trust funds without the approval of the Board of Trustees.
Okay, thank you. So through this, and I really appreciate your detailed explanation of this. There was more that I learned in this from what I knew previous, so I appreciate it. But it sounds like it's very interesting to me that as we go forward in the next couple of years, and I expect that every department, and that includes Health and Social Services, will feel some sort of pinch. And it looks like there's potentially, and this is where, as kind of the board of directors of the state, and we sit here and look at the finances of the state, I have a little concern, because there will be money that will be available out there to be expended, and we do not have really the ability to say, I think that's an appropriate direction for the state to go, appropriate utilization. There's the ability to just totally skip us, essentially. And so there, obviously, I hope you understand where kind of that concern is from my perspective, is because things are changing as a state, and it looks like there's potentially a lot of money out there available to utilize in manners that the legislature may feel is different from the direction that we want to go. So, but I really appreciate the detail that you gave us to help us understand that.
Well, Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I think your point is right on, and the flip side of that is the opportunity that the state, the legislature, and the administration have to work with the trustees to further what you want to see done. And frankly, this RPL is a part of that, in my view. You want to reduce the cost for this general relief program. What we're offering to do is to assist in that by paying for an assessment of the 600 people in the program to find out, is this really what they need? Is there a cheaper alternative to serve them? Can we access other funding sources? Is there a way to reform this program so that not only will the current reductions not harm beneficiaries, but future reductions can be achieved? So it's a two-edged sword in the sense that there's an opportunity there for you to work with the trust as well, which is exactly why, under the settlement, the trustees make recommendations to you. If you don't agree with them, you write a letter to us every year, and you explain why you didn't do what the trustees proposed, and if you wish, what you would like to see done differently. That's an important part of the settlement. That feedback directly from the legislature and the governor, but directly from the legislature to the board, saying, look, these are the recommendations you made that we agreed with. These are the ones that we didn't. Here's why. Here's what we think you should do differently. And we welcome the opportunity to be full partners in the reform and budget reduction future that we all face, which is why, for example, the trustees funded the contract for the Department of Health and Social Services to look at reform in the Medicaid program, because if we don't reform that program, it will not be sustainable. And when it collapses of its own weight, if we don't do something collectively about it, then our beneficiaries are going to be the ones that get harmed. So we're very wanting to work collaboratively with the legislature, because that's the only way our beneficiaries are going to be successful in the coming challenges that we all face.
And Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, but it still gets to the point of there's always a reason to spend money. There's always a good program. I think just about everything in health and social services is a good reason for. I think they do an incredible job, and there's a lot of people serviced by it. But what's been highlighted here, and that's where the challenge is that there's a growing amount of money where if the legislature feels that that's not the direction that we go forward, it still may be a good program, but maybe instead of focusing on X, we've chosen to focus on Y. But the trustees have the ability to say, we disagree with you, legislature, we're going to go in this direction. And they've got a growing pot of money to be able to do that based on the fact that they have chosen not to place that into the principle of the fund. And so that's where there's some hesitation that I have. It's still the legislature's ability to make policy related to health and social services. I wouldn't say that there's the ability to go around it, or that it's being done, but I think there's the potential there. And that's the hesitation and that I'd like to highlight there. But again, I appreciate the detail.
I've got Representative Sadler, then Senator Hoffman.
Dan, if
you allow me just a little bit of latitude, but Senator Hoffman, did you have an item on this point?
Just a comment on that point.
Please, sir.
Thank you. There are many entities in the state that don't fall under the Executive Budget Act that we don't have control over funds, and I think many legislators may not be aware of it. But this fund is even further, and the legislature decides which ones they are and aren't under. But the Mental Health Trust Funds is even a little bit further protected because it is a settlement. There was a lawsuit against the state of Alaska not meeting certain population needs, and I was in the legislature, and that was a long and drawn out process that we came through and had the settlement with the people that fall under the Mental Health Trust, and I wonder if Jesse agrees with that.
Yes, Senator Hoffman, I absolutely do, and I understand that the Medicaid expansion is very controversial, but I like to believe, and I think most of you do, that the partnership between the trust and the state has been really mutually beneficial for many, many years, starting with the closure of Harborview and putting people into community programs and closing an expensive institution, replacing API, the Bring the Kids Home initiative. Now we spent $16 million of trust funds to facilitate you moving those programs from out of state into in-state services. And now we're heavily investing in the criminal justice initiative, trying to help you control the corrections costs, and bring down the prison population by reducing recidivism. So notwithstanding the issues around Medicaid expansion, I think that this system has actually worked very well to our mutual benefit, and hopefully we'll be able to continue that in the future.
And Jeff, just to put a point on Senator Hoffman's observation there, I think I'd like to just make this really clear. The Mental Health Trust Authority and the funding, the money, the wealth, the money, the land, the resources that you possess was established as a result of the finality of a lengthy lawsuit that was ultimately decided by the Alaska State Supreme Court. Is that not true?
That is correct.
And am I making a correct statement when I simply say that money and those assets were in fact, although you are a government entity, but that money and those assets were specifically by the results of that settlement completely removed from the control of the legislature?
Representative Hawker, yes, with the notable exception that our admin budget, the money that pays for my salary and my staff salary, that has to be approved by the legislature to prevent us from empire building our administrative structure. But otherwise, yes.
Again, your program funds are specifically, and it is only your choice to expend those funds on behalf of your beneficiaries through the legislature's budget.
That is correct, Representative Hawker. And I will point out that, again, even though we make grants outside of the budget process, we have a priority and always have, and I think always will have, to work in conjunction with the legislature and the administration, because we don't want to create a separate mental health program. We're trying to integrate a comprehensive mental health program. So
For example, in this case, we could probably assess these people ourselves. We could do a contract and try to do these assessments. But our feeling was that this is really a departmental function to do these assessments. It would make more sense and possibly even be more efficient for us to have them do the assessments, because they're the ones that have to manage the darn program and get reform implemented. We don't want them to be dependent on us to do their work, although we're open to providing the funding in order to avoid a reduction of service. That $175,000 has to come from somewhere. It's going to come from services to the beneficiaries. So this made sense to us in the same way the previous RPL made sense, in the sense of receiving additional funds to transition from old growth timber to second growth timber, which is something, by the way, the trust is also doing. You know, we're trying to transition from a GF-dependent system of care for these people to a system of care that's more efficient and effective and costs less GF.
And, yeah, thank you. And I guess just to confide with Representative Sadler here, I think this whole dialogue really leads to the point, and particularly Representative Pruitt there, how important it is when we confirm members of the Board of Trustees of the Mental Health Trust. That is the authority that we have over this agency. But once they are confirmed, then they are in the decision-making role. And that's why this sometimes I think we overlook the people appointed to this agency and how truly important the role is they play in the state of Alaska. Representative Pruitt and then Representative Sadler.
Yeah, I want to expand on that. And you're exactly right. Because while I understand the Mental Health Authority's separation, I understand their independence, and I understand what they were made for, the potential here is that there is an entity that has the potential to, you know, move the legislature, move the direction of policy. Because if, as you just highlighted, the department's the one that's going to go forward and do it. And if there's approval by the trustees and acceptance by the administration, even outside of the legislative process, it essentially has the ability to make a state agency accept and move forward on a program that that the legislature did not initially feel was the direction that we want to go. And Medicaid expansion is a great example. So it has the potential of the tail wagging the dog here, and from an entity outside of state government, just based on what we've heard today. And I think that's where it's an interesting dynamic here with what the institution has. And back to your point of why it's important to make sure that there are that we don't overlook all of the people that are being appointed to the various, whether it's the Mental Health Authority or others.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt. We've granted a lot of latitude here, but Representative Sadler, I'd like to have you have a point. I'd like to get then David Teal to give us a ledge finance perspective on this, and then we'll decide what we're going to do with it.
Thank you, Chairman. Sorry for coming late, but I got a brief, I hope a brief question. Mr. Jesse, you called the $1.4 million expenditure unusual. My question is there any precedent in which the trustees have decided to use money instead of inflation-proofing and restoring the shortfall for any other policy priorities? In other words, if you expect to try and do this kind of transaction more often, what are the criteria you use, or is this the first time it's ever happened?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I believe that it may have happened before, although I can't right now recall what the circumstances would be, but I think it's accurate to say that it would be an extraordinary situation where the trustees would look at doing that, because the system is set up to, in its normal course, be run a little differently. I might add that under the settlement, inflation proofing is discretionary on the part of the board. In other words, it says that income from the trust may be used to inflation proof. The trustees have taken the position that in the long run, their fiduciary duty to future beneficiaries does require them to
prioritize using income for inflation proofing, but it's not a mandatory requirement, which you'd be better than I believe is true with the permanent fund, but I'm not sure about that.
Thank you, and that is a very correct statement. That's why we separately appropriate inflation proofing into the permanent fund each year from the available permanent fund receipts. What I'd like, if we could at the moment here, is, David, could I get you to come forward and give us a ledge finance perspective on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need to put my name on the record again.
I think it's a really good idea. You know the drill here.
David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance. And in our comments on this RPL, we noted that the department referred to options under Sections 1915 I and K of the Federal Code, and those options appear to be irrelevant to this RPL because they're not effective until FY18. That point does no harm to this RPL, which is for immediate money to perform assessments to determine eligibility for housing assistance under AHSC's 811 grants, as they're referred to. And that program may start as early as November with the assessments and the housing sometime later, perhaps in December. So the real question we had on the RPL was that it's something that wouldn't have come up until recently when there are decrements in the budget, which until recent years have been fairly rare. And if there had been no decrements, this RPL probably would have raised no technical questions for us. However, the governor and the legislature did cut this program. That was a general fund cut of approximately $800,000. And that led us to question whether adding money back to the program would make it appear that this committee was overriding the will of the legislature. We noted that in our comments, and you have a October 1st memo from Legal Services in your packet. And in that memo, they concluded that the RPL was a valid request because the request for funding was MTAR receipts, and the cut was general funds. So although the legislature indicated that it wanted to cut the program, there's no clear indication that that cut was a desire to cut the services as opposed to simply a pressure to reduce the budget. And since these are a different source of funds, which were not available to the legislature at the time the budget was being reviewed, they then appear as additional program receipts, making it a valid RPL. So given that, our technical issues go away. Clearly, there's an extreme here, which you've seen, is you can look at it as, no, we intended to cut services as well as just reduce general funds. The other extreme is, well, great job, you guys. You found out how to maintain or improve services despite these general fund cuts. You know, it's not my job to tell you which extreme or somewhere in the middle that the committee lands. This is it's purely a decision by the committee, but there's no technical issue with it.
And thank you, David. I think that's really well stated, and I really appreciate both our ledge legal people that were online and David who and your people who prepared this initial analysis. What I think we are facing as a committee here today is that we clearly have a valid RPL from the administration, legally valid, technically valid, but also the concerns raised by Ledge Finance as our counselors to the legislature are also quite legitimate. And that is, if we approve this RPL, are we contradicting the intent that our finance committees gave us, that some of us supported out at the end of the legislature. So that's why I wanted to take this very lengthy discussion, this very lengthy analysis of this, to really see what's on the table. What does this committee want to do? And is the action we take something that would be condoned or not condoned by the larger legislature that we also sit here in representation of? So that's my question. I have just been through Representative and Senator Jesse, Jeff Jesse, Mental Health Trust, please.
Just one more comment. David referenced 1915 I and K as not being very relevant to this RPL. We would respectfully disagree because we're looking at reform going forward, and we need to know about these 600 people so that we know how to shape reform to get them served while minimizing the draw on general funds. So although in the short run, I would agree, it doesn't directly affect this RPL. It is part of a longer-term reform strategy to understand more of what these people need and what they might be eligible for that would reduce general funds.
Mr. Thiel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with that. I didn't mean to imply that they were irrelevant. They are irrelevant to this RPL because the RPL process is typically seen as a short-term thing that the legislature didn't have a chance to address. This section 1915 options, because they're available starting in FY18, one would expect the full legislature to deal with this issue and the long-term reform aspects. The RPL itself deals only with the AHFC program.
Good clarity on all points. Senator Hoffman, sir.
Thank you, and I would additionally state that the $800,000 cut is still going to be in effect, and these additional funds are one-time funds that are not reoccurring, so I don't see how this affects the legislative budget that we've adopted.
Okay, well, I'm going to take hearing C. Do we have any more questions at this time? Hearing C, none. I'm going to take a brief at ease, please. On the record with the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee reviewing the RPL request from Department of Health and Human Services for additional receipt authority for Mental Health Trust Authority authorized receipts. I think we've had a really thorough discussion of this, and I really appreciate everyone's participation, and I think it really fleshed out a real solid grounding to make a decision here. Madam Vice Chair, do you have a motion for us?
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that the committee approve the following RPL: 06-6-0217, Department of Health and Social Services, Senior and Disability Services, General Relief Temporary Assistance, Living Client Functional Assessment, $175,000 Mental Health Trust Authority authorized receipts as an operating budget item.
Okay, the question before the committee is the approval of the receipt, $175,000 receipt authority from Mental Health Trust Authority. Is there objection from committee members? Hearing C, none. That RPL is approved. Congratulations. Appreciate everyone for going through that one. What we're going to do next is we're going to go into executive session for the purposes of discussing a confidential level performance report, an initial performance report. Madam Vice Chair, do you have a motion for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee enter into executive session under AS24.20.301 to discuss confidential performance review reports.
The question before the committee is going into executive session. Is there objection? Hearing C, none. So ordered. It's approximately 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This is the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee convened in the Anchorage LIO for We have just come out of executive session where we discussed the still confidential preliminary draft performance review reports for the Department of Health and Human Services. In accordance with statute and protocol, we have now the need to have a motion put on the table to release these reports to the agency where they will be commented upon and then come back to this committee for final approval and release publicly in approximately a month. So before we do this, I would like to reaffirm that we do in fact have a quorum here. Representative Olson, are you available?
Yes.
Thank you. And Senator Hoffman, are you available?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We have also present, we have Senator Giesel, we have Senator McKinnon, Representative Hawker chairing, we have Representative Keto. Adding those up, we do get our requisite six members to move the, or to pass this motion to release these documents to the agency for comment. So with that, Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee release the Department of Health and Social Services preliminary performance review reports of the agencies for response, behavioral health, long-term care, administrative structure.
So we have the question before the committee is moving the three preliminary reports, one on behavioral health, one on long-term care, one on administrative structure, the Department of Health and Human Services, to the agency for their comment. Is there any objection from committee members? Hearing see none, congratulations everyone. We're moving into the next phase. Much appreciate that. While we're still on the record, does anyone have anything to bring before the committee for the good of the order? Hearing see none, I thank everyone for their participation today, and we are adjourned.